Zardayan believes that an angle of such assassinations to destabilize the region and those who were behind his assassination should be severely punished.
As the ambassador of Iraq, we extend our condolences to the Iranian nation. Iraq has repeatedly seen many of such assassinations carried out by its enemies. Therefore, we fully understand the depth of the tragedy. We condemn Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination and call on the international community to get united against all forms of terrorism.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the town of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. He was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but succumbed to his wounds. The scientist had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote a once peaceful nuclear energy program.
We believe that if countries remain silent towards such acts of terror and assassination, terrorists will become emboldened to continue their acts of terrorism. Therefore, ambassador and military attaché of different countries have signed a memorial book both to pay tribute to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and condemn his assassination.
Experts believe the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt a once peaceful nuclear program.
The ambassadors and military attachés of different countries who commemorated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh strongly condemned his assassination, saying the main perpetrators should be brought to justice anytime soon. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, where the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, while the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is too low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting any help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering.
Faisal al-Miqdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept it, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU's seemingly positive ambitions, there are many analysts who agree the nuclear deal will not be saved because ultimately the Biden administration will bow to Israeli regime pressure. Trump's hate speech towards Iran, fueled by the powerful Israel lobby, has been relentless during the past 4 years.
We're going to hit you with a force 1,000 times bigger than you've ever been hit before.
Despite Trump and Israel's best efforts, some expert analysts believe Iran's political leaders can still save the nuclear deal.
It is a sensitive issue. And like in the U.S. Congress, also in the Iranian parliament, there are people who are, if not opposed, at least critical. But the foreign ministry and the government, I think, are very, very determined to carry out this deal.
Biden has said he wants to re-engage with Iran. Tehran has made it clear matters will not be progressed at any price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The call on the Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to resign followed the incessant killings, armed robberies, kidnappings, banditry, and the over a decade insurgency in Nigeria's northeast. Prominent elders, members of civil society organizations, religious leaders, politicians have advised the president to resign because he has failed to live up to the oath of his office to protect the lives and property of Nigerians.
He has failed on his own promises, the promises he freely made to Nigerians in 2015. People can no longer travel from Abuja to Kaduna, a journey of less than 200 kilometers. So what is the essence of being in government if you cannot protect lives and property, which is the basic responsibility of being in governance? This accounts for why Nigerians are asking Mr. President to resign from office.
But Nigeria's Minister of Information has fired back, saying no amount of hysterical calls for resignation will prevent the president from serving out his second term in office. Experts agree that President Muhammadu Buhari has not lived up to the expectations of Nigerians, but resignation is not the way to go. They said a citizens-driven security system is a new trend the world over, and Nigerians should get involved.
All the strata of leadership in Nigeria, in general, and in northern Nigeria in particular, to live up to their responsibilities. When we say strata of leadership, it cuts across the military, the political class, the traditional rulers, the religious leaders. They should come, rise up and face the realities of these particular challenges that is facing northern Nigeria in particular and Nigeria in general. But Buhari should lead the way by example.
But the problem of insecurity in Nigeria facing President Muhammadu Buhari has started attracting the attention of the legislators. Some members of the House of Representatives have invited the president to come and answer questions on the security situation in Nigeria. President Muhammadu Buhari says he will honor the invitation, but no definite date has been fixed for the meeting with the lawmakers. Experts believe that the ordinary Nigerian deserves peace and protection in Nigeria. Protection, they said, to freely go to his farm, harvest his crops so that he can feed his family. They said fear has now dominated the minds of many Nigerians in their homes, on their farms, and along highways where criminals kidnap and kill with impunity. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened. And now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation, but we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional about that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives, and you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules, but it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes me proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly. Like, the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines. Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
It's being called the jobs report without a silver lining. United States corporate media is unable to put any positive spin on the number of new jobs produced in November, coming in at a whopping 60% under the initial prediction. It's the lowest monthly addition of jobs since April, coincides with a tripling in long-term unemployment since only September, and makes clear that temporary unemployment caused by coronavirus lockdowns have repeatedly led to permanent job losses.
The jobs report may be the final nail in the coffin of a so-called snapback economic recovery, which was so widely touted by the mainstream media last spring. A social recovery for the long-term unemployed and their dependents may prove to be just as difficult to achieve.
As seen following the 2008 recession in the U.S., the social effects of long-term unemployment include mental health problems, increased drug and alcohol addiction, an erosion of employable skills, and lasting family dysfunction. With stocks just having their best November ever, it's now clear that the U.S. has had a K-shaped recovery, with the rich and poor classes headed in opposite directions.
It's in shambles right now. There's no question about that. We're in the worst crisis for U.S. capitalism since the Great Depression. And this crisis isn't getting better. I mean, bills are compounding. Rent is compounding. It's not like things are getting better. For people who haven't been able to work, you know, they still have to pay. These numbers are still piling up. Medical bills are piling up. Utility bills are piling up.
The second wave of coronavirus has hit lockdowns, and not more funding for healthcare is again America's solution. The new lockdowns are being called a gift to Amazon by small local business groups, and will likely worsen the already bad unemployment situation, just as they did in spring. At the same time, pandemic stimulus unemployment benefits are scheduled to run out the day after Christmas for 15 million people. Data from MIT University estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program, from the first and only federal stimulus plan, spent nearly $250,000 to save each job. However, the maximum compensation to workers was capped at $100,000. The annual median personal income is just $33,000. It's caused many to wonder where the money for jobs really went. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Protests in Pakistan against the UAE was unthinkable until recently. However, now it is not so unusual after the UAE diplomatically recognized the apartheid regime of Israel. The public sentiments against several Arab rulers rose in Pakistan after the UAE and Bahrain started aligning their foreign policies with Israel and India. The normalization of Israel's ties with the UAE and Bahrain is now affecting Islamabad's long-standing relation with some Arab rulers, particularly of Saudi Arabia and UAE. Citing unspecified security threats and rise in coronavirus cases, the UAE now has banned visit and work visas to Pakistani citizens, along with 13 other Muslim nations, most of whom have been angry with Abu Dhabi after it normalized ties with Tel Aviv.
Countries like UAE receive such direct investment from investors from Israel and, for that matter, American Jewish community. Then obviously the UAE government and the investors from Israel or, for that matter, USA would be cautious about how the local population, for that matter, how the immigrants might react and respond to direct presence of the Israeli or, for that matter, American Jewish investors in countries like UAE.
Without revealing their names, Prime Minister Imran Khan in a recent interview dropped a hint that Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been pressurizing Islamabad to normalize its ties with Israel. Islamabad has vowed not to give diplomatic recognition to Israel. Over 5 million Pakistanis work in UAE and Saudi Arabia, the two biggest remittance-generating Arab states.
Pakistan's economy is dependent on these remittances. Saudi Arabia and UAE have the tools in their hands to put pressure on Pakistan to recognize Israel. Pakistan's nuclear power has always been a problem for Israel. So therefore, Israel would love that Pakistan should give recognition to it. That's why UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and other GCC countries want Pakistan to give recognition to Israel.
Political analysts say that Pakistan is running out of options, and in the current situation, it may inch closer to Turkey, Qatar, Iran, and more particularly to China to offset pressure from Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are strengthening their alliance with Israel, US, and India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the United Nations has said that Yemen is the most pressing humanitarian crisis in the world. This is the Saudi regime, along with its regional allies, and support from some Western countries continue to bombard the poorest country in the region. Yemeni blood is on the hands of many, but what will be done about it, and how can the suffering be stopped?
The humanitarian crisis in Yemen has been exacerbated by the incessant war and siege over the past 6 years. The executive director of the World Food Program, David Beasley, confirmed that the number of people facing the second highest level of food insecurity will increase from 3.6 million to 5 million in the first half of 2021.
There is indeed a humanitarian catastrophe, and if aid arrives, it goes to other places, and 70% of it goes to United Nations organizations to cover operational expenses. The other side must stop the blockade completely, because it affects Yemen in the medical, educational, and food sectors. So we think the focus should be on the root cause of the problem, which is the siege on Yemeni people.
Beasley called on the international community not to abandon the millions of families who are in severe need of aid. Millions of people are on the brink of a new famine as the UN's Yemen response faces historic shortfalls. $1.5 billion is what the donor governments contributed, while the UN says it needs $3.2 billion to avert the crisis.
Those who provide aid, such as the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and America, have failed and did not abide by their pledges they made. They spent more than these sums to buy weapons, but they do not help Yemenis as they claim, which confirms the authenticity of the United Nations reports that famine is on the rise in Yemen.
The coronavirus pandemic, along with the funding crunch, has forced dozens of aid agencies and organizations working in Yemen to scale back their assistance. Some of them even had to give up their programs entirely, which has deteriorated the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the UN. Famine can still be prevented if the international community wakes up to take serious action to save the lives of millions in Yemen, including women and the children. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Hossein Al-Bakhati, Yemeni activist and a political commentator out of Sana'a, and Eli Joseph James, a radio host and political commentator out of Chicago. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in Sana'a. Hossein, we've been hearing about the devastating effects of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen for years now, especially regarding children and starvation. Is the international community unable to stop this, or is it choosing not to address this, and why, if that's the case?
Of course, the international community, they can stop this aggression against Yemen and war and blockade and constant Saudi attack on Yemen main infrastructure by actually pinpointing who is the one responsible for this war on Yemen. We remember that in all UN statement or UN envoy to Yemen, either the British one or Mr. Griffith, they haven't actually mentioned Saudi Arabia as a part of this war, or United Arab Emirates, or all the countries that supported this war, like United States, France, and the UK. They call it as a civil war, and this actually they want to deceive and mislead the international media, and to deceive as well the international community, because when there are 17 countries involved in this war, they force blockade on Yemen. If you call it a civil war, this means that you actually not taking the responsibility from Saudi Arabia and other countries. And as well, we remember that United Nations actually has appointed Saudi as a member of the Human Rights Council in Geneva during the war in Yemen, and they have removed Saudi Arabia twice from a list for killing children, because as the UN Security General at that time, I believe was Ban Ki-moon, he said because of pressure from Saudi Arabia that they will cut all the aid to the United Nations if the United Nations will not take Saudi name. This means that for Saudi Arabia, this is a green light that they can continue their war against Yemen. They can continue the blockade. As you mentioned in your report, the World Food Program, they said 5 million people in the coming month will actually have food insecurity. There are 17 million, according to United Nations Agency and some NGOs, that 17 million Yemenis are in urgent need of aid. And with all that, with the coronavirus and the blockade, I believe, and it's clearly, as the United Nations have said before, is one of the worst humanitarian disaster in right. the world. But still, they okay. are not saying who is behind this, because before we haven't had any of this illness or this food insecurity.
Well, let me cross over to Eli in Chicago. Now, for more than 3 years, Saudi Arabia has implemented that illegal blockade that our other guests have been talking about on Yemen, blocking roads, ports, and air traffic, making getting in basic necessities very difficult. So all of these things are man-made. Where's the outcry and where's the pressure on changing this reality in order to at least get the basic necessities to these individuals? Millions and millions of people are on the verge of starvation.
Well, there is none. There should be, worldwide, there should be an outcry, but all you get is a posturing, hand-wringing from the politicians of virtually every country except from those countries that are most affected. This is, to me, an exact repeat of what the Israelis have been doing to the Palestinian people for, well, since 1945 and even before, that the outcry is controlled by the mass media of the international corporations, which have no real interest in the suffering and the well-being of the affected peoples. But what they do are interested in is maintaining supply of arms, the supply of materials to the people that they do business with. And apparently the Yemen people are not sufficiently good customers for the international community for them to be concerned about. This is a humanitarian crisis that reeks to high heaven and also down to hell, because the United Nations could be doing something, but they're not. Now, my understanding is that this began in 2015 when Saudi-led coalition began bombing Houthi rebels who had forced Yemen's president Hadi into exile. So as far as I'm concerned, this started out as a civil war. Your other guests could correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the Saudis have no business getting involved in internal affairs of Yemen. That's my position on this.
On the one hand, the UN continually warns about the danger of the situation in Yemen. On the other hand, UN member countries, even some of those on the Security Council, continue to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, the regime mainly responsible for the onslaught on Yemen with, of course, other regional countries. So then what does that mean? Can the UN be counted on or it cannot? And on the other hand, how can we expect these countries to help then improve the situation in Yemen?
I think the involvement of this country like United Kingdom, France, and especially the United States is one of the main goal of the start of this war. We've seen that it's not all about bringing Hadi or that they call the legitimate government to Yemen. We've seen that what the United Arab Emirates is doing in south of Yemen. They have created militia and group. They have made ties with Al-Qaeda and ISIS to fight Sana'a or to fight Ansar al-Houthi, and those groups actually do not recognize Hadi government, and they have fought several times in the south, and that's one of the main goals of the war, to control and secure the shipping line in Bab al-Mandeb and in Socotra Island. And the other goal is to sell more weapons to Saudi Arabia. Those three Western countries actually are making billions of dollars in profit from this war. According to The Independent, I think about 1 year or 2 years ago, they said the United Kingdom has increased its sales of weapons to 500%. And as well, during Obama administration, the war started on Yemen with the green light from the United States. And they have sold the highest rate of weapons to Saudi Arabia in the history of the United States. That's why I think if those countries actually still making profit, they are not going to stop this war. They will continue using the United Nations and the UN Security Council to only actually blame Sana'a as
so
every
Hussein,
time Sana'a targets any military installation.
Hussein, let me just jump in here.
Yeah.
So are you saying, for example, that the United States support for the Saudis in this onslaught against the Yemenis, it's all economic? Is it because of the billions of money that Washington gets and London gets from selling weapons? Is that the only reason that they are supporting the Saudis in this onslaught? Or tell me about what you think on that side of things.
Yes, this is one of the main reasons. And the other reason is, as I mentioned, is to control and secure the Bab al-Mandeb Strait. Is one of the most important shipping line in the world. And Socotra Island, it's situated in one important area south of Yemen, and to control ports and airports, especially in Aden and El Mahra. And this actually gives the United States and the Zionist state a foot or a presence in those area, because when the revolution in Yemen has took place in 21st of September 2014, the United States didn't like that, because here Houthi and as well the government here now in Sana'a are anti-United States foreign policy, and as well they are against the occupation of Palestine and against the Zionist state of Israel. All that actually is what has actually given the green light to Saudi Arabia to impose and to start this war. And I just want to add one thing. We've seen many times lately in the media that if Biden will come into power, maybe he will stop the war, because he has made many, many promises during his campaign. But I think this is a big lie, because the United States have the same policy. It doesn't matter who is in control of the White House, but at least actually Trump, he was honest with all his promise during his campaign. He has actually implemented those promises. But Biden, I'm sure that he will continue selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And the war started during Obama, who was given the Nobel Peace Prize during his administration. This actually shows the goal is economic goal to sell more weapons and as well to secure and to control Yemen, because the strategic place where Yemen lies is actually given an interest for the United States and other countries.
Well, Eli, according to the UN, at least half of the country of Yemen is on the brink of starvation. As I said earlier, this due to man-made causes. Your take on this tragedy and what can be done in order to change this around?
Well, the UN strategy is very much the same as Israeli strategy, because the Rothschild banking family created the United Nations and created the Israeli state shortly after creating the United Nations. So whatever happens in the Middle East is essentially the policy of the banking firm of Rothschild & Company, who essentially control all banking operations in the entire world, with the exception of some Muslim countries. They even control the economic operations of communist countries. So the overall strategy in the Middle East of the Rothschilds is to destabilize every single country within the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, including Iraq, Iran, what have you. Everything that the Israelis claim for themselves under their false claim that they are the people who have been donated by God, that whole area from the Tigris-Euphrates all the way to the River of Egypt. But that's false. They are not the people to whom God donated that territory to. That false claim is what created the Zionist state. So ever since they created the Zionist state, they have been using this tactic of pitting one Middle East country against the other. And in fact, Iran has become the new Nazis of the world. Once they got done with Nazi Germany, now they blame everything on Iran. That's why they don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. They don't want Iran to have anything. They want to destroy your country just like they destroyed Germany. And they're using constant chaos in the Middle East, pitting one Arab nation against another Arab nation, against the other nation, against et cetera, et cetera. This is all that they're doing, and the United Nations is not going to end it, because the United Nations are mere puppets of the Rothschilds. Over to you.
All right, well, Hossein, the Yemeni people have fought back as best they could against the blockade on its country and the all-out war being waged against them by the Saudis and Emiratis. Now, this was a war that Riyadh said would be over in weeks, and now it has been more than 5 years. What happened? How could Riyadh miscalculate to this degree?
Actually, they actually miscalculated. They might have done this actually on purpose, because at the beginning of the war, they blamed Iran for, as they say, sending all these weapons to Sana'a forces. And after 3 weeks of blockade and constant bombardment, we've seen that the spokesperson of the coalition, the previous one, Mr. Al-Asiri, he said that they have destroyed 85% to 90% of the capacity of weapons that Sana'a forces has. But after that, it clearly was actually the opposite. And this actually proves that there is no weapons coming from Iran, because this blockade, who's responsible for not allowing for food and medicine to come to Yemen, all ships that arrive to Yemen are searched by the United Nations, are searched by Saudi Arabia, by the coalition, by American forces in the region. So how can Iran smuggle weapons? That's why the miscalculation started from that. But Saudi Arabia used this excuse just to get an attention from countries like United States and the United Kingdom and others, to get the full support, because they want the international community to believe that there is a real presence for Iran in Yemen. But to be honest with you, there is no presence. Yemen has a huge amount of weapons. They had about 600 ballistic missiles. They have developed new weapons like drones and cruise missiles. And according to the army spokesperson here in Sana'a, he said yesterday that Saudi Arabia are in the final stage of losing this war. And the Yemenis actually has not started to attack and target like airport in Najran and Jizan and Asir, south of Saudi Arabia, only because Saudi Arabia is keeping targeting Sana'a airport and other airport and keeping this blockade. And I just want to mention that I expect in the coming days or weeks that Saudi will continue to target Sana'a airport, because we have seen in their media in the last 72 hours that they claim that Sana'a airport is used as a weapons base for the Sana'a forces. And this is actually so silly, because you Sana'a forces will leave all the country, will leave all the mountains they have, all the hills, all this huge empty space to use the Sana'a International Airport. But because this airport is the last lifeline for Yemenis, and actually the exclusive client for this airport is the United Nations, but they haven't said anything when Saudi have targeted the airport on last Friday. That's why I believe Saudi now want to close this airport totally, even for the United Nations. But I believe if this will be done, then the Yemeni forces will take a huge step, and they will target Saudi Arabia main infrastructure, and they will target like a large airport either in Jeddah or in Abu Dhabi or Dubai or Riyadh, because they always say after any attack that if Saudi will stop and lift the blockade, we will stop. So the one responsible for the war to continue is Saudi Arabia and all the country behind it.
Well, Eli, what is the goal of Saudi Arabia now with this onslaught and blockade continuing? Does Riyadh just want to starve and torture the Yemeni nation to death?
It appears that way, but the reality is, here in the West, those of us who are savvy to the Zionist occupation of the entire Middle East and the Zionist occupation of virtually the entire world, is that they need to make boogeymen, a boogeyman. So they've made a boogeyman of Yemen, and they have no consideration, concern, they have no humanitarian concern whatsoever for the people of Yemen. And as long as the people of Yemen are caught in the middle of this game where the nation of Saudi Arabia is being dangled by the Israeli puppeteer to do the bidding of the Israelis, because as your guest pointed out, they have all these strategic operations going on that the Israelis want. Number one, the Israelis want to destabilize the Middle East for their own purposes, and they create strife among different Muslim groups to fight amongst themselves. They created the Wahhabi sect. The Rothschilds actually created the Wahhabi sect. I don't know if your listeners are aware of that. And they have been using the Wahhabi sect, and Saudis were instrumental in supporting the Wahhabis against other Islamic religions.
Okay.
So this has been ongoing for, several hundred years. Several hundred years. Back to you.
Hossein, 1 minute. What is it going to take to bring this onslaught on Yemen to an end?
I think the only, just that Saudi Arabia and United States and other countries back in Saudi Arabia, they only recognize the power and the one who is strong in this war. And I think if the Yemeni army will keep targeting Saudi main infrastructure, especially the oil field, this is where it actually hit and hurt Saudi Arabia, because they depend 100% on oil to buy all these weapons, and as well to buy the United Nations and United States and all that. So if they do that, they're going to as well hurt the economy of the United States and UK and other countries. And I believe if they continue this type of attack, if they can actually stop Saudi from exporting oil, I believe that this war going to end. And we remember just about maybe 1 week ago, after the attack on Aramco in Jeddah, United Kingdom has sent some troops to Saudi Arabia, as they say, to protect the power and the oil field in Saudi Arabia. This means those targets actually going to hurt those countries who selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And this decision actually should be taken by Sana'a, and they have as well responsibility to do so.
All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for being with us on this debate out of Sana'a. Hossein Al-Bakhati, Yemeni activist and political commentator. Out of Chicago, Eli Joseph James, radio host and political commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thank you so much for joining us.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, the main goal of the Iraqi dictator Saddam of initiating the 8-year war and invading Iran was to overthrow the Islamic Republic system. This integration of Iran was his secondary goal. Saddam said in a speech in the beginning of his invasion of Iran, "We won't be upset at disintegration and annihilation of Iran, and we announce that if the country is adverse, every Iraqi person, or maybe every Arab, will intend to disintegrate and destroy Iran." The Iraqi foreign minister at that time, Tariq Aziz, also said, "A few smaller Iran will be better than a single Iran, and we support rebels of different Iranian ethnicities, and we'll make every effort for disintegration." Anthony H. Kurtzman, Western pundit, said, "It appears that Iraq has not really analyzed the effects of attacking a country that was in the middle of the revolution's course. It seems that Iraq had simply assumed that its attack will lead to Iran's disintegration rather than solidarity and unity. Even some of the Iraqi leaders in their interviews had admitted that they had never thought that their attack would have such an effect to cause a rising of masses in support of Ayatollah Khomeini." Wafer al-Samarai, the head of Iran's section at the Iraqi Security Service, said, "At 12 o'clock of September 22, 1980, 192 jet fighters of the Iraqi Air Force flew towards their goals inside the Iranian soil. At that moment, the commander-in-chief, Saddam Hussein, entered the operation room with a red keffiyeh on his head and a cartridge around his waist." Then Iraqi Defense Minister Adnan Khairullah told him, "My master, the youth flew 20 minutes ago." Saddam said, "We will break Iran's back within half an hour." These hollow remarks and this much of a ranting were thwarted thanks to the selfless combatants who, under the unmatched leadership of Imam Khomeini, brought the Iraqi dictator and his Western and Eastern bloodthirsty supporters and partners in crime to their knees. American expert Alan Friedman, quoting the White House official, said, "Our forces would grant a lot of tactical helps to the Iraqi military at the war front. Sometimes they would even go to the Iranian border alongside Iraqi soldiers." And this continued till 1987. Howard Teacher, a senior expert of the U.S. National Security Council, said that what the U.S. did for Saddam, it had not done to any of the close allies. Kenneth Timmerman writes in his book that Saddam, in June 1982, signed a contract with a Belgian company worth $830 million. The aim of that costly project was to build a bunker for 800 Iraqi advanced fighters at a depth of 50 meters underground. The project was dubbed as Project 505. The Belgian company benefited from the Belgian government's credits. During 4 years, it constructed 17 air bases and several military bases in Iraq. The French Mirage aircrafts would fly from the same bases to attack Iran. The Belgian consortium built the largest factories for chemical examinations and production of phosphates in the world. Timmerman continues that the United States of America, before sending its envoy to Baghdad, had deployed a full-time head at the American intelligence station in the capital. He had a high status with Saddam and would be consulted before every great attack. Alan Friedman writes that delivery of weapons continued almost on a daily basis. One of the NATO bases was located in central France. It was the place of loading Antonov bombers of the Iraqi Air Force to carry cluster bombs and radar equipment to Iraq. As we had said earlier, French intelligence services had estimated that if they had cut help to Iraq for 3 weeks, the Iraqi army would have failed. The chemical weapons and assistance that the Western regimes granted to Saddam claimed over 100,000 martyrs and injured among the Iranian armed forces and civilians. Some of the chemical weapons included phosphate compounds and mustard. It was the second time after the First World War that such weapons were used widely in war. This measure of the Iraqi regime was in utter violation of 1925 Geneva Protocol. Iraq used these lethal weapons both in the fronts and over the Iranian cities. The city of Sardasht, with nearly 12,000 people, was one of these civil areas that was bombarded by the Iraqi bombers on June 28, 1987. Saddam's criminal army dropped bombs of mustard gas over the city, causing a gruesome disaster. Today, there are still over 50,000 Iranians who are suffering from the effects of chemical bombs and missiles of Saddam. The most horrendous chemical crime of Saddam's Air Force was the bombardment of the Iraqi city of Halabja in February 1987 because the people of the city had accorded warm welcome to the Iranian forces. In that heinous crime, more than 5,000 Iraqi Kurds were massacred in cold blood. Some 7,000 others also sustained serious injuries. The gory crime has been compared with the atomic bombardment of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the end of the Second World War. The UN Secretary General in the years of Iraqi war against Iran, Javier Perez de Coya, in response to whether Iran's defense of legitimate or not, said, "There is no doubt in it. This was the best thing that a nation could do against aggression to its nation. It is different to have a fight between two armies than an army and a popular resistance." Iran's resistance against Iraq was a popular resistance. That's why it caused Iran to triumph. You triumphed because you succeeded to resist against the aggressor and pushed him back.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.